your next great vacation might be something you've never even considered. A private yacht in a beautiful location just for you and your closest friends and family. Explore the beaches of the Virgin Islands, the ancient shores of Greece, or the tropical paradise of Tahiti. This is not a cruise. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings. And it's easier than you think. With hundreds of award-winning yachts to choose from, located in over 20 beautiful sailing destinations, the world is in your hands. Whether you're an experienced boater or looking for a more genuine once-in-a-lifetime vacation, The Moorings can make your dream a reality. Call us today and start your journey to your next great escape. Your private yacht awaits at moorings.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the latest film and TV news. My name is Ben Pearson. I am an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer and box office analyst, Ryan Scott.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
All right, Ryan, let's jump into a listener email before we get into the news. Belinda from Chicago writes in, I'm always surprised by jokes made about people in the above 55 age group. Are there demographics for the ages of moviegoers? I'm an avid moviegoer, and it seems like the movie industry is making more grown-up movies for me, like Tar and Oppenheimer. What do you think? First of all, I hope Belinda's not talking about us. I mean, maybe we joke occasionally about some older folks going to the movies, but maybe she's talking about just... more broadly speaking, in culture in general. But anyway, what do you think about the demographic question, Ryan? I know that there are some sort of demographic, there's demographic information out there, but what do you make about the part about, is the movie industry actually making more movies for grownups these days?
It's an interesting question, right? Because, you know, what does that really mean? And I think if you're going to look at the demographic question, you know, yes, studios, theaters, the industry at large does have like demographic breakdowns for how they look at who's going to what movie. So, and a good example is Top Gun Maverick brought out a lot of older moviegoers that, you know, hadn't been back to the movie since the pandemic began. So, you know, that is important and that can be important. But by and large, what's interesting is Belinda's asking, like, you know, hey, are they making more grown-up movies? And it's like, well, sort of. You know, Oppenheimer was an almost $1 billion success that went on to win Best Picture. That was very much a quote-unquote grown-up movie, and it's the kind of movie that it seems like in some ways that Hollywood isn't making. But more to the point, I think, is that a lot of times those grown-up movies, quote-unquote, fail. They get made all the time. Tar was a relative success, but... you know, it didn't really do very well at the box office, like it very acclaimed and stuff. So, you know, that's kind of on the polar opposite end. I did bring up some stats from a few places that I could. You know, in 2022, it looks like from Statista, people between 18 and 34 went to the movie sometimes, whereas people 35 to 44 represented about 45% of the movie going population. And 10 of the people who were in this particular survey who were over the age of 65 never went to the movies. So I can say anecdotally that my grandparents before the pandemic used to go to the movies all the time. Now they literally haven't been since. Mm-hmm. That's a problem the industry's facing. The one thing I would point out is that I think what happens most of the time is that the Hollywood is focused on, you know, at least 30 or older. If you look at the superhero movie trend, even Spider-Man at this point, which sure you might get kids that way, but you know, people that grew up on Spider-Man 2002 are probably at least in their 30s now. You know, these are kind of movies for older folks. Comic collectors are older people. You know, so even those movies are more or less aimed at older demographics. Part of the surprise of Five Nights at Freddy's last year is that it did so well despite like critical panning and being available on Peacock. A big part of that was that younger moviegoers came out en masse. And that was a franchise very specifically aimed at younger people, which, to my view, Hollywood tends to ignore much more than older folks. So It kind of depends how you want to look at it. You know, I think you can, you know, opening up the adult drama conversation versus non-franchise stuff, that's a different conversation. But in terms of pure demographics, Hollywood tends to focus on the older people because there is a perception that they are the ones with the money, is sort of the way that I see it.
Yeah, it's kind of like making more grown-up movies for people since when, right? Because like when I was growing up in the 80s and 90s, it seemed like there were a ton more adult dramas back then. And like the sheer number of overall things that are being produced has skyrocketed because of all these different streaming services and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, right? We've talked about that before, but like the balance seems to be a little bit off. So I'm glad that Belinda feels like the movie industry is catering to her particular desires and needs as a moviegoer, because that's great to see. And that's great that she'll continue to go to the movies. And it's always good when you feel catered to, right? But like, we talked sometimes about the, on this show about like the audiences that aren't being catered to. And you mentioned young people earlier, and it just seems like once every, I don't know, 13 months or something, there's a movie that's made specifically for women and it does huge numbers. Yep. And Hollywood's like, what is this? Who could have predicted? You know, we've had those conversations a bunch too. So it's a complicated thing. But
yeah, It Ends With Us right now is a great example of a movie aimed almost squarely at women. It's made $100 million in 11 days domestically, and it's a movie that cost $25 million to make. It's also a movie aimed at, you know, not young people, right? Because, you know, again, it is super complicated. I don't know why Hollywood makes the decisions they make, but yeah, there's a lot to that. But at the very least, it seems like if Hollywood's going to take anything away from this particular listener email, it's that, you know, people like movies like Tar and Oppenheimer, and they should continue to give them a shot.
Yes, definitely. Okay, so let's get into the news. There's a couple Joker 2, Joker Folie à Deux stories that I've put here in the show notes. I know you and I, Ryan, are not particularly interested in Joker. I mean, maybe we'll talk about the movie once it comes out, but I personally am not interested in really like hashing out all of these stories in the lead up to the movie's release. I know a lot of people are, and a lot of people loved the first movie a lot more than you and I did. So I'm just going to put these here. So if you're one of those people who's really interested in the stuff, you can very, very easily check it out by just clicking the link in the show notes. But Ryan, I'll spare us from having a conversation that nobody wants us to have on podcast.
Nobody wants to hear you or I talk about the finer points of this movie, because it's going to devolve into negativity. The only thing I'll say is that I wrote up a little piece based on this Variety profile that they did, and he addressed the movie's budget in a way that kind of boiled my blood. I don't know, but that, again, nothing but positivity from me here.
And again, I'm leaving room in my mind and opening my heart to the idea that Joker Folie à Deux might be an amazing movie. And if it is, which I certainly hope it is, I'll talk about it in those terms, you know, once I've actually seen the film. But, as for right now, like this first wave of pre-release hype or whatever you want to call it for the movie, I think maybe if I had a different person on as a guest on this episode, maybe we could delve into this stuff. But I know that you and I have talked about this movie and these movies enough that that I kind of can basically write the conversation before we even have it. So
we're not doing anyone any favors by like sitting here, because like, again, so, you know, it's not that we don't want to. Not that we don't want to honor your interest, dear listener, but me and Ben are not going to end up making this fun for you. So
So there's one box office story that I wanted to mention that I should have probably included in yesterday's discussion, which is Longlegs is now the biggest indie horror box office hit in a decade. And I know we've talked a lot about this movie and its surprising hit status and all of that. But I don't know. Can you contextualize that for me and for our listeners a little bit, Ryan? Because that sounds like a very big deal.
It is a huge deal. So this broke on Friday, which I think is part of the reason we didn't talk about it, because it kind of was in advance of the weekend. So Neon was the one that reported. I don't think the Box Office Mojo and the numbers databases have totally caught up with it. But per Neon's own reporting, Longlegs is now past the $100 million mark worldwide, which includes $72 million in North America, which is utterly insane for a movie like this. And phenomenal for a movie with a $10 million budget. But, you know, Neon, yes, they're a distributor with a name, but, you know, this movie was independently financed and picked up for distribution domestically by Neon. So it is very much an indie horror movie. And look, there's different ways to calculate this stuff and what have you. By my personal calculations, and I am open to being wrong, Longlegs is now the biggest indie horror hit since James Wan's Insidious, which came out in 2011, and that made $99.5 million worldwide on, I believe, a $2 million budget. I mean, that movie was made for nothing. But yeah, I mean, so this is a phenomenally successful movie, to put it lightly. You know, just at the raw numbers, but the fact that, you know, they were able to get this sort of attention and everything from an indie film and really become the horror breakout of the year, in a year that was very much devoid of horror hits up until this point. So, I mean, it is a very, very, very impressive thing. And as I joked a couple of times, I am prepared to call this the most unlikely $100 million hit of the 2020s thus far. So, you know, that is, I know that's a bold statement, that I stand by that 100%.
Okay, so the next story we have here is why Michael Keaton doesn't care about Batgirl's cancellation. And I have to say, I was a little bummed to read this.
Michael Keaton was
profiled in GQ, I think earlier this week, maybe yesterday, maybe earlier today even. Anyway, he basically, the interviewer asked him if he was disappointed by what happened with Batgirl, which, as longtime listeners will know, was just completely shelved as a tax write-off last year. And Michael Keaton had a big role in that movie. Leslie Grace starred as Batgirl. Adil and Bilal were the directors behind that film. And David Zaslav, the CEO of Warner Discovery, just decided to scrap the movie entirely and take a tax write-down on it. So Keaton was asked if he was disappointed by what happened there. And his quote was, "No, I didn't care one way or another. Big, fun, nice check." And then he paused for a minute and said, "I like those boys," talking about the directors. "They're nice guys. I pull for them. I want them to succeed. And I think they felt very badly. And that made me feel bad. Me, I'm good." And I was kind of like, oh, man, Michael Keaton. Like, I know that it's unfair of me to expect everybody that I like and respect in Hollywood to have the exact right thing to say at the drop of a hat, you know? But still, I feel like for somebody like Michael Keaton, this could have been an opportunity to take a stand against what everyone knows is just a really shitty business practice and is just a really bad move that David Zaslav made. And coming from Michael Keaton, that would mean a lot more than it does coming from jagoffs like you and me, Ryan. So I just kind of was disappointed that he didn't use that opportunity to speak out against that practice, because who knows if this becomes, God forbid, this becomes something where it happens more and more and more in the industry and just kind of becomes common practice over time or whatever. I hope that never happens. But I don't know, the louder people are against this stuff, the less likely it is that it becomes common practice. I completely agree.
I had the same reaction. I love Michael Keaton. Like, I really genuinely love the guy. And I just really was bummed out by, like, I don't know. I mean, because even if he didn't want to take like a hardline stance, he didn't necessarily have to be like, "I made my money." You know, it just came off. And I had the same similar thing. John Cena was getting interviewed the other day because he's got that movie Jackpot out on Prime Video. And someone asked him about Coyote versus Acme. And his wasn't quite as bad as Michael Keaton's, but his response was like, it was similarly like, you know, "I got to believe they did it for the right reasons." I'm like, what right reasons are there? Like, you know, and it's just like the same thing where these guys could make a huge impact by, and I understand they want to work or whatever, but like Michael Keaton probably isn't chasing work at this point in his career. And I got to imagine John Cena is going to be okay. And the same thing, like, you know, James Gunn, who is the co-head of DC Studios now, had a hand in Coyote versus Acme. I believe he cooked up the story for it. Like, these are all people that, you know, either have not said anything or have kind of said things that are just outright disappointing. And yeah, in the wake of stuff like this continuing to happen, it is a little disappointing that people that could make a difference, nobody cares what I think, you know, like, unless I say something they don't like, so yeah, I'm with you, man. It was very, like, profoundly disappointing.
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point, too, is that, like, these guys probably potentially want to work for Warner Brothers again in some capacity. And, like, maybe that could be a kind of the type of comment that could get them blacklisted or something like that from the studio. So, like, I don't know. On one hand, I get it. But, like, I feel like it's okay for me to be disappointed, too, even though, like I said, I try not to hold people to, like, unrealistic standards, because you never want to set people up to fail in your mind. And like, these are just human beings at the end of the day too. Like, I don't want to glorify anybody too much. But it just, yeah, seemed like a missed opportunity to me. So, all right, let's take a break and then we'll come back and talk about some more movie and TV news.
Your next great vacation might be something you've never even considered. A private yacht in a beautiful location just for you and your closest friends and family. Explore the beaches of the Virgin Islands, the ancient shores of Greece, or the tropical paradise of Tahiti. This is not a cruise. This is a yacht charter vacation with the Moorings. And it's easier than you think. With hundreds of award-winning yachts to choose from, located in over 20 beautiful sailing destinations, the world is in your hands. Whether you're an experienced boater or looking for a more genuine once-in-a-lifetime vacation, the Moorings can make your dream a reality. Call us today and start your journey to your next great escape. Your private yacht awaits at moorings.com.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
All right, so Pacific Rim is getting a prequel TV series. Eric Hesserer, I think is how you pronounce his name. He's the writer of Arrival and the Vin Diesel movie Bloodshot and the remake of A Nightmare on Elm Street. He is going to be at the helm of a Pacific Rim origin TV show from Legendary Entertainment. And I was wondering what you thought about this, Ryan, because my thoughts on Pacific Rim are, I thought that first movie was okay, even though it's a Guillermo del Toro movie, everybody loves del Toro. I just thought it was like fine. There's some like fun stuff in it, but it didn't really work for me in like the pure home run way that it worked for a lot of people. Cause I feel like that movie is almost a cult movie at this point, even though it cost a lot of money to make. It was like a very big blockbuster at the time. And I think Pacific Rim Uprising, the sequel that came out several years later that had nothing to do, where del Toro was not involved at all, was just like really bland and pretty forgettable. But what do you think about this? Are you interested in seeing a Pacific Rim origin TV show?
I don't want to see Pacific Rim on TV, like period. Like I don't, animated would be fine, I suppose. But I say this as someone who absolutely loves Pacific Rim, the original. That goes for everything that I stand for as a moviegoer, and it's one of my very favorite theatrical experiences of my entire life. I think I've written on Twitter a couple of times about the night that I saw that movie. I just don't have interest in a show. For me, you know, I'm with you on Uprising, and I think that was a huge missed opportunity. Del Toro was prepared to make that sequel. Warner Brothers was going to make him wait. He didn't want to wait a year to make a movie, so he went and made Shape of Water instead. That worked out very well for him, but it's very, you know. So I don't know. But Del Toro's name was not mentioned anywhere in this announcement. And to me, that's the thing, is like, is he involved at all? Because, like, you know, that's how you get me interested. But as of right now, you know, I've said it enough on this podcast. I don't need to belabor the point. I'm not a big TV guy. There are exceptions. I will watch, you know, and obviously if it's connected to something I dearly love, it's a good way to, you know, become an exception. But I don't really know how you do this on TV super well. I have to imagine the relative success of Monarch Legacy of Monsters.
I was just going to say, I was going to bring that up, and I was going to ask you if you tapped into that at all, because that is very much aligned with a franchise that you love on the big screen.
Yeah, so this is an example of where I fail at TV. Like, I watched the first, I believe, 4 episodes of it, and I liked it well enough, but I just didn't... I actually intend to finish the season at some point, but I just didn't get around to it. And I feel like it, because Pacific Rim is purely predicated on like big popcorn cinematic action, and I understand there's a lot to explore in the world, particularly as a prequel, like when the monsters start coming, how does humanity sort of respond to that, and blah blah blah. And so I'm not saying there isn't story to mine, but I'd be much more interested if they said like Del Toro was coming back to make like a Pacific Rim prequel movie. I would be like screaming from the rooftops, like, we did it, you know, but that's not what this is. So,
Yeah. It seems like Del Toro is not, as you mentioned, he was not mentioned in the news about this. And like, certainly you would want an Oscar winner involved if you were the people involved with the making of the show, and like the people who put the press release out and stuff. They would absolutely have been like, that would have been part of the headline if he was actually involved in this in some way. So I think it's fair to assume that he's not touching this project at all. So
yeah, my sense is that he got a little burned. He felt a little burned by what happened with Pacific Rim 2, and you can look into it. We don't have a ton of time to talk about it, but pretty dumb situation if you ask me. And making Shape of Water completely changed his career. You know, he's mm-hmm. been able to kind of make more a range of projects that maybe he wouldn't have been able to make were it not for that movie doing what it did. And I think he's just completely refocused what he wants to do. So, mm-hmm.
So speaking of TV adaptations, Poltergeist is getting the horror TV treatment from a couple of writers. Kalinda Vasquez and Robbie Thompson are going to be the writers and showrunners and executive producers of this new Poltergeist show. Vasquez previously worked on Star Trek Discovery and Prison Break, and Robbie Thompson worked on Supernatural and was the showrunner for the Supernatural prequel show called The Winchesters. This is one that, again, like ostensibly has a tie to a franchise that I'm assuming you're pretty interested in, Ryan, with the original Poltergeist being an all-time classic. But what do you make of this one?
You know, Poltergeist is one of those movies that I should like. It is so aligned with everything that I love that I should feel some strong kind of way about it. But truth be told, I haven't seen it in years and years. I don't like remember loving it as much as, you know, one would suspect that I might. But the one thing I will say is I don't quite know how you sort of stretch this conceptually out to like 10 episodes or whatever. It feels like a 90-minute ghost story to me. I don't know. I guess unless you're going to really explore some stuff, or maybe like an anthology is what I could see more than anything, I guess. But like just using the Poltergeist name is like to tell a bunch of ghost stories, but that doesn't sound like what this is going to be. So,
you know, what might be cool is like the Robert Zemeckis movie Here that's coming up, where like the whole movie is supposed to be this locked off one shot camera angle where the camera doesn't move and it goes back to dinosaur times and then sort of tracks the lives and evolutions of these different characters that live on a house that's built on this property or whatever. Maybe something, I know they're probably not going to be as ambitious as that for a Poltergeist TV show, but maybe something along those lines. And in terms of like stretching out the narrative, I'm just completely spitballing here, by the way. I have no inside knowledge on this at all. But like part of the big thing about Poltergeist is like, oh, this suburban neighborhood is built on an Indian burial ground, I think is what they call it. So like maybe you could go back in time and explain what happened there and you know, dig into some of those characters before they get wiped out or whatever. And like, yeah, create some narrative momentum that follows through into whatever the modern day or the 1980s, if they decide to set this movie then, or this show, then there are any number of ways you could go with this, but yeah, that's interesting that Poltergeist is not really like one of your quote unquote, your movies, you know,
it's one of those ones I've been meaning to revisit for years. It's just, you know, cause like, again, I haven't seen it in a very long time. Cause I've had movies like that where my memory of them is whatever. And then you watch them as an adult and you're like, oh, this is amazing, you know? And
yeah.
But yeah, so I don't know. I think it's a good movie. Let me be very clear, but, it makes zero sense to me as a TV concept. So I don't know, because there's certain things that could benefit from it. Like, absolutely. I don't get it. Like, I don't get why this ghost is, like, it doesn't make sense. I don't see what the benefit is. But
yeah,
I'm happy to be proven wrong.
Yeah, well, these writers are veterans of writing longer seasons. I think that's a good sign for people who like old-fashioned TV, of like really digging into long seasons as opposed to like the 6 or 8 episode kind of thing. So maybe if all goes well, Poltergeist could be one of those shows where you could really like settle in and get to know the characters in a big way and things like that. So I'm sure we'll be talking about this more as trailers come out, casting news and stuff like that. So stay tuned for more about that. Speaking of TV shows, one more TV show that we're going to be talking about in the horror realm as well is Peacock has a Friday the 13th prequel show that we've talked about before on the show, but now it has a new showrunner. So tell me about that, Ryan.
Yeah, so just a very brief recap here, because this has been kind of a two-year saga. A24 made a big deal with Peacock for a show called Crystal Lake, which is going to be a prequel series set in the Friday the 13th universe. Hey, look, suddenly I'm interested in TV. But originally Brian Fuller was supposed to be show running this show. And they had apparently made a deal where Peacock had essentially agreed to make at least two seasons of it. Fuller had spent quite some time developing it, and then earlier this year was unceremoniously kind of removed from the project. It sort of depends, and it's a little hazy, but it, you know, so it left it on sort of uncertain footing. Well, now a guy by the name of Brad Caleb Kane has come in, and he is going to serve as the new showrunner and writer of the series, which apparently Peacock is still trying to move forward with, along with A24. Worth noting that they had already spent a fortune, it sounds like, on what in development on what, you know, Fuller's version was going to look like, with Charlize Theron possibly eyed to star as Pamela Voorhees at one point, and just didn't go down that way. So anyway, that brings us to Brad Caleb Kane, who's now apparently going to do his own version of it, rewrite it. What's fascinating is that Kane, among many other things, is the guy who is the singing voice of Aladdin and was for many years at Disney. He has since moved on to be, you know, a guy behind shows like Warrior and Tokyo Vice and Black Sails and these big TV shows. Like, he has a resume that supports him taking on the show, but it is fascinating that he, at one point, his biggest thing in his career was being the singing voice of Aladdin. So it's kind
That's pretty amazing.
The Aladdin to Jason Voorhees pipeline is fascinating. We sort of framed it as such for an interesting hook for the show, but let's be clear, this guy is a lot more than Aladdin. Like, it's just an interesting factoid, I suppose. But the guy's resume does speak to, you know, I'm qualified to handle a big show. But it's kind of fascinating. I think it's more of a nice example of, like, hey, people can be more than one thing, you know, and you know, careers go in all sorts of interesting ways. I think of Ke Huy Quan, you know, who was, you know, one of the most prolific child actors working in, you know, Temple of Doom and Goonies. And then he just basically couldn't get acting jobs for years, became like a stunt coordinator and all this stuff, comes roaring back with Everything Everywhere All at Once. You never know. And so it's kind of like, I find it interesting in, as it relates to Mr. Kane here. So it's kind of, I don't know how I feel about him as far as this show. You know, Brian Fuller was like kind of got that eyebrow curl when he was announced. I don't have as much familiarity with Mr. Kane's work, but we'll see. I'm kind of in the bag for this one no matter what, because I have been craving more Jason Voorhees content for a very, very, very long time. So if this is how I get it, so be it. I would love a movie. That's what I want more than anything else. My understanding is that there has been, for years, there's been a rights issue with this franchise, and the only way they were able to sort of wrangle the rights together had to do with TV rather than a movie. So, you know, to the small screen, my fandom goes, I suppose. Ben, I don't think you and I haven't really talked about, do you have any, like, affinity for the Friday the 13th movies at all? I don't get the sense you would.
I've seen the first three, and I think that's it. So I would say no. I mean, I kind of watched them just to check them off a list. You know, I wasn't really like passionate about them. I was just kind of like, let me dip my toe in here and see what everybody's talking about so I can have like a conversant ability to maybe carry on a very, very loose conversation with somebody or something about this, if this ever comes up in my pop culture travels, you know. But yeah, this is not really like one of my franchises, I should say.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah,
that was like me with the Harry Potter movies when I finally watched them, and all it resulted in me was, you know, hating Dobby and everybody getting mad at me for hating Dobby. I didn't really get any other benefit from it, so I get it.
What an incredible take, Ryan. Dobby.
Yeah, I know. It's everyone's like, what, you know, because we'll talk about them, and I'm like, yeah, they're fine. Dobby sucks.
Oh, man. All right. Well, I expect a lot of email feedback on that alone. So I look forward to that. That's okay.
Send them to me. Don't bother Ben, please. Bother me. I said it, not Ben.
Okay. All right. The last story that I wanted to talk about is is something that just really tickled me. We get a lot of press releases in this line of work, and most of them are pretty bad or boring, but every once in a while, something comes along that just kind of tickles me for some reason. And such was the case this morning when I received a press release for something called Movie Scent, one word, S-C-E-N-T. And it's basically a smell-o-vision type of thing for your home. And you pay $180 for this machine that has six individual scent bottles pre-bundled with it, with scents like ocean, fresh cut grass, forest, storm, restaurant, whatever that smells like, and clean air, which is supposed to be used as like a, it's kind of like a palate cleanser. Like if you're watching something and ocean, like an ocean comes on your screen or whatever, the ocean scent is supposed to blast through your living room, I guess. And then you use this clean air one to kind of like even things out again before another smell comes up. So this was just fascinating to me because like Smell-O-Vision was, I believe it made like a Time magazine reader survey of the top 100 worst ideas of the 20th century. So just the idea that people are like, you know what we need? Smell-O-Vision, but for the home is kind of like, I don't know. I was very just personally interested in like why anyone would think that this is a good idea or an interesting idea. So the way that this works, Ryan, is that it uses AI to, once it's plugged in, first of all, it works with TV, PC, mobile phones, tablets, gaming systems, and like VR headsets, according to this press release.
So it works with like literally everything.
Yep. It says that basically you plug it in through an HDMI port, a 3.5 millimeter audio jack, or an optical audio cable connection. And then the way that it works is, I'm going to read the quote here. Audio is then processed by proprietary AI technology, which identifies key cues and events within the content. The AI identified scent is then released from the scent atomizer, creating an instantaneous and synchronized sensory experience. So the whole thing apparently is based on sound cues, and I'm not really convinced that that's the best way to make this work, because some of the other scents that they have, in addition to the ones that I mentioned, that are going to be available in the next few weeks are fire, jungle, zombie, new car, and blood. So
the zombie one, oh my God, imagine spraying that smell in your house.
Yeah, and blood is not necessarily something that I'm eagerly looking forward to smelling in my own home either. But I'm just curious about how that actually works. Because, like, you know, maybe if I'll give them the benefit of the doubt and say that, you know, I guess if you're watching something and a character goes to the beach, maybe you have a seagull in the background and the crashing of the waves, and like maybe there's enough aural information there for the AI to be like, oh, this character is at the beach, let me choose that smell, right? But for something like blood, how does this technology, if it's based only on sound cue, how does it differentiate between different types of liquids on screen? I'm not really sure how that works. I'm not really sure there's enough people out there who are interested in this to pay almost $200 for this sort of novelty Spencer's Gifts-esque thing that just sits in your home. But I don't know. What do you make of this, Ryan? Is this something you would actually be interested in trying out?
If it wasn't in my home. I gotta say, I do conceptually think it's interesting to, you know, create a more immersive experience. Like I've seen tons and tons of people talk about like seeing Twisters in 4DX, right? You know, like that being like a great experience. If you don't know what 4DX is, it's these immersive theaters where, you know, your chair will move, or they'll like spray a little bit of water on you if it makes sense of the screen, and smells. And so, you know, it is sort of that. I guess it's trying to bring some semblance of that experience to home viewing. And I'm okay with that. I am okay with that. It is a fascinating, I'd be fascinated to see how it actually works in execution, right? Like that's what this all, cause like there's a version of this that's pretty cool. You know, but man, I'd be fascinated to talk to these people. Like I'm just like, well, you know, but
yeah, and it's worked before in the past too. You mentioned 4DX, but also the big thing that I was thinking about was the ride Soarin' at Disney theme parks. I don't know if you've ever either been on that or heard about this ride, but it basically, like, you sit in a big thing and they kind of strap you in, and it simulates the effect of you being on a hang glider, and you just kind of float in front of this giant, it's smaller than an IMAX screen, but for all intents and purposes, it's a gigantic screen in front of you. And there's like first person POV, essentially drone or helicopter shot footage of just traveling, a camera, like traveling over beautiful different locations in the real world. And you go over like an orange field and they pump orange smells in there. And then there's like rose blossoms and stuff like that. Yeah. So, you know, the smell component has actually worked before. And I mean, I mentioned smell-o-vision. That was like a real thing back in the day. And like theater owners have been trying to use smell as a way to heighten the cinematic experience since even before talkies came into the mix. So this is a very long-held idea that, like, I think they've scientifically proven that smell has a powerful connection to emotions and experiences and stuff like that. So that's clearly what they're going for here. I feel like there's a big difference between, oh, I'm going to go on this theme park ride where this thing happens. I'm going to wait in line and experience this 3-minute thing versus having a thing in your home where you smell everything you watch or interact with. It's just like, it seems like a little overkill to me. But
I got to say, I'd probably never leave my house if they did this for Chef accurately, you know, where I could like smell the Cubanos all the time.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, there are again, like the zombie thing, I can't get over. Like, I don't want to smell Night of the Living Dead. Like, I really, really don't.
They say that 40 additional scents will launch over the next few months as well. So I have no idea what those are going to be, but maybe one of them is Cubano.
So it's $180 and it's a lifetime thing. Like, you don't have to, is this like a, oh, I have questions.
Buy the actual device itself, and then you probably have to buy the scent bottles individually.
Well, that's what I was
going to
say.
On.
Then you've got to buy like all these different scent, but I have so many questions for these people. please.
The last thing I'll say is that each of the scent bottles can apparently release over 4,000 times. So it does seem like you're getting your money's worth with those things anyway. But who knows? Anyway, movie scent. Check it out if you're interested. I just thought that was pretty funny. I'm not sure how viable this is going to be as like a true business thing. Or who knows, Ryan? Maybe it's going to like revolutionize the way that we all consume media moving forward.
To quote Kumail Nanjiani from Central Intelligence, I am made of questions right now.
All right, that's going to do it for today's show. You can find more about all the stories that we mentioned on today's show at slashfilm.com. I will link to a bunch of them in the show notes as well. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailback topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thanks so much for listening, and we will talk to you all tomorrow.